Yes, here we go. What a guest we've got on again today. It's the band with the biggest hands ever. They're so strong.
They're not that, but they're getting smaller. They're getting smaller, Simon.
Very strong, though. A handshake, man. I'd love a cuddle off them.
That's an Irish handshake. I learned that from the great Sean Fallon. He used to catch your hand always.
Brilliant. As you say, Irish hands, grew up in Donegal. What was football like for you as a kid? Were you a goalkeeper always?
No, well, I played outfield until I was about 12, and I didn't. I could play, I was nippy, I could go around people. Then I got too tall, I started to grow, and I lost all my coordination. But I went into goals then, I went around about 12, and I had a twin brother, Dennis, of course, and Dennis played outfield, played League of Ireland football also, Dennis. So the two of us were out in the country, so it was great to have a twin brother, you know, when you're doing that shooting and stuff, you know. You go into goals for a while, then you would do a bit of shooting, and then he would go in, but he didn't like it. So I was the one that popped in goals most of the time. So I enjoyed it, Simon, and it was good. And the other big difference between here and, say, Donegal at that time was we played on grass. You guys played on ash here. And you never created goalkeepers because of it. Well, I can't say that. Alan Ruff and those guys were going around the time.
Did you play Gaelic?
I played Gaelic.
Boys that toughened you up as well.
Tough as nails. I'll tell you, I played Gaelic football, played corner forward, then played midfield, didn't play in goals. And that really toughened me right up. I played all levels for my county before I went away at 17.
Wow. Were you a Celtic fan growing up?
Yeah, Celtic fan, a Spurs fan.
Right.
We were kind of dominated with England a little bit over there because we got BBC Northern Ireland and we got ITV, so it was all English football. But Scottish football, of course, I didn't see Celtic play live, but we had all the stories of, and next door neighbour worked over here, used to come back, he had a big photograph of the Lisbon Lions up in his wall, and I could name every player. When I was a young boy, myself and Dennis would go over and we would go through all the players. And from that perspective, we were really Celtic supporters from day one, but I think we were dominated with English football. So Spurs, and the reason for Spurs, come on, Pat Jennings.
Oh, Pat Jennings.
The great Pat Jennings.
Was he your hero, huh?
He was my hero. Right. So that's why I followed Spurs. And they're in the Champions League final, you know, but listen, I don't know, I'm very neutral at the moment.
Do you still follow them, huh?
No, I wouldn't say. I probably have a wee soft spot somewhere in the back of my mind about them, but... you know, when you become a player with Celtic, Celtic dominates your life.
Takes over,
you kind of forget about the English stuff, you know.
Yeah. Sean Fallon spotted you.
The great Sean. Sean was a fantastic man. I met Sean for the first time in Dublin. We were training for a youth game, and Sean came over to me after the training, and he was out training and watched me in a game, and he came over and said, "How are you doing, son?" You know, he had that lovely Sligo accent, and asked me, "Would I like to come over on trial?" And I said, "Of course," because I had been over to Leicester City for about a year, over and back. I was still at school and I was over and back, and Leicester showed no interest in signing me at the end up, so I was desperate to get one last chance. And Sean asked me, "Would I want to go over on trial?" And I said, "Yes." And he says, and Sean always did things right, you know, the Celtic way. And he said, "We'll be in contact with your club." And right enough, he contacted the club, KG Rovers, was a local junior team I played with. And they invited me over in 1977, long before you were born, I think, Simon.
So is it just you that came over yourself?
My mum and dad came over with me. We stayed up with my aunt and uncle up in Murrend. And Sean picked us up and dropped us off and did all that with his big car. And going into Celtic Park was, you know, an incredible... For a 17-year-old, it was quite incredible coming from Donegal to go in there and mix in with the... At that time, I'm trying to think who was at the club. Pat Stanton was there.
Wow, right. Johnny
Doyle, of course, was there. And he was there a couple of years after I signed. I'm trying to think. Roy Baines was the goalkeeper. Peter Latchford, the goalkeeper. So I was out training with them. Jock Steen was the manager. So it was a kind of a unique time. Ronnie Glavin was there, Paul Wilson was there, and then the young guys like Tommy and Roy that I went on to play with. But going in that door for the very first time, and Sean, no, typical Sean, he took me straight into the first team dressing room. And I had a big duffel coat on, a hand-me-down duffel coat, I think it was. And I went and he introduced me to all the players that was in there.
Did you get slaughtered for the duffel coat?
I did. I got slaughtered for years afterwards for a duffel coat, but I kind of threw it away. And then I got a new coat later. My wife got me a great coat. I'll tell you a story about that later
go
on.
Go for it. No, tell us now when you go.
Oh, my wife got me this fantastic coat, lovely coat for Christmas. And what do you not do, Simon, at Christmas? Bring in your Christmas
your new
presents.
Gear, new gear.
You leave it out. So I brought it in anyway. And we were actually supposed to go up to Barrowfield to play. or the train. And then there was a kind of a bit of a delay, and everybody left the dressing room, and I was kind of last out. And they said, "Oh, we're out on the track." And I went through the tunnel, and I went out on the track, and they were all out in the tunnel, lined up, and they started cheering and clapping. And my new coat was up above the jungle, on the flagpole, blowing with the hands like this here in the wind.
Who would that have been that had done that?
Tommy stole it, of course, and gave it to Hazy, you know, to stick up on the flagpole.
Brilliant. You were Jockstein's last ever signing for Celtic. How was it to play under?
I didn't know Joy. I was over there on trial. And what I do remember about him was that they were going through a kind of a rough time at the time. They weren't winning a lot of games and that. And I remember going out, and I don't know what we were doing, and we might have been running on the track again, but Jock was in the middle of the centre circle and just walking on his own, kind of up and down. I think that's where he went when he was in good form. Spoke to me a couple of times, and then, of course, came over to Donegal to sign me. And, you know, the incredible thing for me was that he was actually leaving 2 weeks later. Now, he may have got the sack because he signed me. I don't know, possibly. But I think, you know, I owe him so much, because most managers, if they were leaving the club, wouldn't bother about a young kid from Donegal to go over and sign him, I'm sure. But he did. He came over.
Did he come to your house?
No, we met out in the Ballyraine Hotel, which is now the Mount Errigal in Letterkenny. Got the word that that Jock was coming over. Celtic wanted to sign me. In fact, I didn't know it was going to be Jock. Celtic wanted to sign me, and my mum and dad drove out, and we went out to Letterkenny, and then some of the team or the officials from Cage Rovers went out also, and we were sitting and waiting and waiting, and then next thing the door opened, and then walked Jockstein. My God. And Fran Fields, the chairman of Finn Harps, was with him. Now, there's another story behind Fran Fields. Fran was with Finn Harps. He was the chairman of Finn Harps at the time, and there was always a deal to be done. Fran did it. So that was fine. I signed with Celtic, and £70 a week, and I got £1,000 sign-on fee, and joined them then the following July. And Jock had gone, had left the club, and Billy McNeil took over. And then a couple of years into it, Billy came in one day and said, "Oh, to all the lads," he said, "we need to go over to Balbuffet to play Finn Harps in Finn Park. And I was like, "Oh, what is that?" He said, "It was old when Packy signed." I had nothing to do with Finn Harps. He was a chairman. I was playing with Cage Rovers. And poor Cage Rovers, it didn't get the... They should have got the money
and
in
Finn
the
Harps
deal.
Got it.
Oh, and it was credit. It was Charlie Nicholas's last game. Absolutely.
Right. So the boys, I was a couple of years in there.
I got so much stick at home, you know, because I had... they love going over to Donegal. Anybody would.
What kind of guy was Jockstein to look? See, when you met him, your mum and dad, was he quite a...
He was intimidating, big man. You know what I mean? You can imagine him walking in there. And I can't remember what he said. All I wanted to do was sign the contract, as you know. But he did say to me, he says, "Listen," he says, "you're getting £1,000 sign-on fee, and make sure you look after your mum and dad with that." So I think I gave probably most of it to my mum and dad, and then I took a couple of hundred to buy a suit or something,
that
which I didn't have.
The duffel coat
went and the suit came in, you know.
You mentioned Tommy Burns. How good a teammate and a friend did he become over here?
He was special because, you know, he lived beside me down the road just. And from day one, I think we became good friends. He brought me into the house, to Rosemary, the first time I moved into a house right beside him. So he brought me in. We grew up together just made me feel at home. And we had a great time together, myself and him. We used to drive in together. We used to pick Frank McGarvey up on the way, by the way. That was a threesome in the car. And we're always kind of on the last minute, you know. And Frank wasn't very happy because if we were late at that time, you got fined. You got fined 25 right. quid. It didn't happen too often. But I remember one day, my next door neighbour, Meg, she was a lovely, lovely lady, actually. And she's no longer with us. But she was 9 months pregnant. And I remember coming out the door and Meg was coming out her door. And I says, "Where are you going?" And she says, "Oh, I'm going into Rotten Row Hospital for a checkup." But she had no car. And I says, "Come on, jump in." So she jumped in the front of the car. And I went down, picked up Tommy. And Tommy introduced Tommy to her and grand. And then it took off in to pick up Frank McGarvey in Menig Road. And at the top of Menig Road, you're supposed to turn right to go to Celtic Park. Well, I turned left. And Frank says, where are you going? And I says, "I need to drop Meg." Now, Meg was in the front, 9 months pregnant. And I says, "I need to drop Meg in Rotten Row. She's going for a checkup." "What?" He says, "What?" Oh, for God's sake, we're going to get offended. He says, let her go and get a bus. And poor Meg was like that. But I didn't. I dropped her off in Rotten Row. And Frank, unfortunately, we got fined that day, I think.
Where was the dad, Frank McAvaney?
Sorry?
Where was the dad, Frank McAvaney?
Frank McAvaney? No.
Was he the dad? No.
No. Oh, Frankie boy. Frankie boy.
Because I've heard Tommy's wife tell a story that when he was going on holiday, he never had a passport. And she said, he says, I'll just use Paggy's.
No, it wasn't a passport, it was a credit card.
Oh, credit card, was
it? Was a credit card, yeah. Just use Paggy's credit card.
Was he daft or really?
Tommy was fun, you know. I don't think Tommy would have... he wasn't a man around the house, anyway. He wouldn't have been able to change a light bulb.
So did you do that
for him? No, I didn't do it. I think Rosemary did all the work around the house. And that. But he was daft, and we had a great time. We had great sing-songs and all of that kind of stuff. The stuff that normal people have, we had it, and we had a great group out there. There was Roddy McDonald, there was myself, there was Tommy, and then of course the lads would all sort of congregate our houses, you know, and we'd have sing songs at night. And I remember a fantastic fancy dress party we had at Christmas, and there's some great photographs in the house. Danny McGrain's dressed up. I don't know what Danny was he dressed up as a woman or something, I'm not too sure. But we were all dressed up. Davy Proven was there. Oh, it was a fantastic night. And and Tommy loved to sing songs, as you know.
Great,
it was always a fight between himself and Charlie to see who was going to sing first.
Who was better, Charlie Nicholas or Tommy?
Tommy was much, much better than Charlie.
Another player breaking into the team at that time was Paul McStay.
Yeah.
Could you tell straight away how good he was?
Yeah, I think so. He was young when he came into the team. I think he was an exceptional player. Played in the middle of the pitch. I'll tell you what Paul had. He had the ability to take the ball when he was marked. People said, pass the ball into Paul. You know that way that you have somebody sort of kind of either on your left or your right behind. Paul knew exactly where they were without even noticing. And he had a lovely little thing that he used to do, a training exercise. And you might have done it yourself when you were playing. He would get a circle of the young boys, and he would get different balls, and he would play balls into him, and he would play it off first time, or he'd let it, take a touch and then run through it and then play it off. And then he would put somebody in to mark him. And he would go short, and whatever side the guy was on, he'd let it run out the other side. And that was his little exercise. I remember him doing it a lot with Brian Scott when he was maybe an injury or that.
Right.
And I think that's what sort of obviously learned him and made him one of the best midfield players probably in Scotland, if not in England at that particular time.
Would he have been the best you played with, certainly?
Yeah, well, Danny was a great player. What Danny had was the ability to take the ball off you and pass the ball 30, 40 yards straight to a player. He had a great ability with Charlie Nicholas when Charlie played as a young boy, and he had this telepathic sort of understanding. You know, if Charlie would come in on the inside, he would play the ball down the side for Charlie, and that's where Charlie wanted. Or if Charlie went wide, he would play it on the inside of him. And they had that thing going. Fantastic man, fantastic guy to be around when we were young, you know, because he encouraged you and he made things happen, Danny, you know, for you, you know.
So you'd be being a young goalie, who would be the one that would be shouting at you all the time? Roy Aitken?
No, Roy was scared of me. No chance. I was a shouter. I was a guy. I was a shouter, you know. Who would I be scared? I wouldn't be scared of any of them.
No.
But I had to stand up for myself. Goalkeepers had to stand up for themselves in those days, you know. I remember Billy obviously taking over, and there was Tommy McAdam, there was Roddy McDonald, there was Shuggie Avalson, there was Roy Aitken, there was Tom McAdam, there was Billy himself, and we used to play these mad mentals, we called them 40-a-side, whatever it was, and it was mad. But all he did was pump balls in the top of me, and because I was young and he wanted to harden me up, he just, about five or six of them used to come in and absolutely hammer me, smash me, and that was the training. Then, you know, and then we used to play our little 5-a-side stuff, you know. But Danny, going back to Danny, you know, I remember playing in the charity game a number of years ago. I don't know, many years ago now, probably 10 years ago, when there was 50,000. We played Manchester United at Celtic Park.
I remember it.
It was a magnificent day. And Danny, you know, Danny's, I don't know what age Danny is now, it's 10 years ago. He's probably
90,
yeah. But he was there, and he says to me, and he stripped. And I said, Danny, you're not playing, are you? And he says, oh, yeah, good. But don't give me the ball. Don't give me the ball. You know, don't give me the ball. I'll just go and tap it. So half time, he comes on. And the first thing he says, give me the bloody ball. And I had to throw it out to him, and he took it and he passed it, you know what I mean? And that was Danny. He demanded of you. He demanded you to play.
He was your reserve team assistant manager when I was younger.
Oh, right, okay.
He would join in as well.
He
would never give the ball. He would genuinely try and tackle him, and he would do you, and he couldn't get the ball from
it. Over the top, Danny.
Would he have been world class, Danny?
Danny was. Danny, when he in his heyday, you know, before he probably got the injuries and that, he was probably up there with the best in the world. There's no doubt about it. I remember watching him as a young boy in the World Cup in 74 and that, you know, and he was magnificent.
Was he sarcastic back then?
All players are sarcastic. Uh-huh. All the top players are sarcastic.
Were you sarcastic?
No, I was a quiet one. You have to live in that dressing room. You go down to Liverpool, the Kenny Dalglish's and that, my God, the one-liners absolutely slaughter you. But you have to handle that and you've got to get on with it and give it back if you can.
Because he always used to tell us he was in Pele's best ever 11, wasn't he?
Danny, yeah. Did he tell you that, did he?
But
he
was coaching you. Every day. Right, Billy McNeil took over, as you said. How important was he in giving you confidence to go and be the number one?
Well, just picking me in the first place, you know.
Do you remember your debut?
I do. Yeah, St. Patrick's Day, 1979. I think it might have been a Tuesday. And the crowd, believe it or not, were only about 17,000. There was snow around the pitch. It took the snow off the pitch. He told me, I think on a couple of days beforehand, maybe a day beforehand, and there was a postal and telecommunication strike on, so I couldn't even let my parents know. There was no mobile phones those days. No, so you had to either write the letter or you did the old phone at home. Remember the one that you wound up and all that? Yeah. You know what I mean? And that was the ones in Donegal. The ones here was you had to do your finger, you know?
Yeah, I remember that.
I remember going over to Leicester City, actually. When you think back, how foolish we were, but we were quick learners. I remember going over to Leicester City and we didn't have that sort of phone, that mobile phone, that phone that went round in a circle. It was one you wound up or the ones that you put the money in. You don't remember all this.
This is all way
above you. But the guys listening, the old guys will maybe remember this. But I went out to use the phone and there was this sort of ring one where you did this here. And I looked at it for a while and I says, oh, Jesus. And then, because I had a phone home to my dad, at a certain time, and then I went like this here. No, it wasn't working. So I went into the landlady and I told her, listen, I don't think your phone's working and I need a phone home. Can you come out and help me? So she came out and she went the opposite way. You went the opposite way and then let it go and it was away.
Not the brightest. That's why you're a goalkeeper.
I learned very quickly, you know.
First league winners medal in 1981, age of 21. Was it quite surreal?
Yeah, well, we were in the team then, you know, and it was getting into that team was difficult. We had a really, you know, when you think back in the team, it was a fantastic team. Murdo McLeod, David Proven, Tommy Burns, Roy Aiken, Danny, Bobby Lennox.
Wow.
And then Charlie was breaking through, myself. So there was a really, really good team, and Peter Latchford was the other goalkeeper. So I got in because he got injured initially and then stayed in the team. And to win first league medal, I think then you feel you've arrived. You've sort of arrived at Celtic, you know. You have to win a league to be there. A cup's okay, but the league is a critical thing.
You said Bobby Lennox, and I never knew that he played. What was
he played like? My debut. Yeah. He scored two goals in my debut.
How was he for a young player like you? Was he good?
I was brilliant. Bobby's the fittest guy you've ever met in your life. Himself and Roy Aiken led the training. We came in pre-season, the two of them were up front. And they were on you go, and you had to follow them, and they kept the pace up. Bobby was incredible.
Did he talk about the Lisbon Lions a lot?
No, not really. Jimmy Johnson came in one day and trained with us. Absolutely, when we were young, yeah. But he chipped me in the five-a-side goal. That's all I can remember. Think
Oh, brilliant. How was he when you came in ahead of Peter Latchford? How was he with you?
Peter was great. Peter was like a coach, you know, honestly. And I think goalkeepers get on well together anyway. There's no room for goalkeepers to be kind of falling out or not getting on because we have the room together. And we know that the next time he's going to be in, I've got to help him, you know. So Peter was fantastic. We had Frank Connor. I don't know, do you remember Frank?
Frank was scary, wasn't he?
Oh, he was scary, yeah. But Frank was brilliant for us. Right. Brilliant. And he was an ex-goalkeeper too. So Frank was the guy that stood up for you, but really put you under pressure to perform. And I was in the reserves with Frank for about a year and a half. You know. And then later on when he came assistant manager and so on.
So Frank, if you had a bad game, would he go through you?
Huh? Oh, aye. Frank would tell you. Oh, aye, Frank would tell you, you know. But he was doing it for the right reasons, you know. And sometimes maybe that's missing a little bit now.
You think so?
I think so.
The characters have gone for the game. You can't shout at players now.
No. It's a different game. It's a different way of dealing with, you know, players now. You have to coax them. You have to talk one-to-one with them. You can't dig them up. All of those things have changed. But at the end of the day, it's all about getting results, whatever way.
Yeah. 1982, one league again. But achieve success in Europe. Standout performance in the Ajax game. How was that?
You've been reading up, haven't you?
I haven't, yeah. Somebody has.
Did you see the pictures?
No, I've not seen the football pictures, is it?
No. It was a great night. It was a great night because...
After or the actual game?
Both. But they carried Big Billy to bed that night afterwards. I think it was Peter Latchford to carry Big Billy up to bed with Frank McGarvey. and then threw him in the bed because he was well gone, and rightly so, because he had just beaten one of the top teams in Europe. And then, big as Frank McGarvey was going out the door, he heard Peter Latchford saying, "Boss, any chances of that new contract?"
he was gone
at that stage.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah, but Cruyff played as well?
Cruyff was coming to the end of his career, and he came back to help that young team. But, you know, the Lairbys, Jesper Olsens, Mjalby, they were all young kids in the team. And then, of course, Cruyff was the senior guy and came back. Graeme Sinclair marked him that particular night, and he was given a task of man-marking him, and I'm telling you now, the ball could be 2 yards from Graeme Sinclair and he never touched the ball. He just ran after Johan Cruyff. And that, but he came off injured near the end, and then I think that's when we scored our goal, you know. But it was a great night. I played well in the game. We got hammered in the first game at Parkhead, absolutely hammered. We drew the game, I don't know how, and then we beat them out there, which was quite incredible in a way. And I think of away goals, maybe we went through, I'm not too sure. But anyway, there was a great night. And
is that common back then? If you had a good result, would you all go together?
We used to stay over, which was different than now. I don't think we left the hotel, but we ended up in the bar, as you would, and have a few drinks and the media, of course. That was the other thing. The media mixed in, would you? You know, and
we did, right? So you all drank together.
The media would have been in the hotel too, and we'd have a few drinks. It's the same with the Irish team. When I went away to the Irish team first, the media was always in around us, and we got on well with them, you know. Mm-hmm. And there was none of them going to really stitch you up, and I think that's missing a wee bit. In the modern world, there's a different, of course, technology has come in, but there's the relationships with the media has changed a lot.
The game's gone. You're, as you say, you're involved in a lot of high profile performances. Sorry, was there ever interest in you for other teams?
I don't know. There was no agents, you know, and we didn't know. I think when Liam Brady took over, I think I did ask away. I thought maybe it's time to move on.
Why?
That was 92. Well, I was at a team and I was, you know, I was 32 years old then, 31, 32 years old, and I felt I would have loved to have gone to Europe. I would have loved to go on and play in Europe. And after the World Cup in 1990, I think it was probably a good time to go. But there was no agents, and nobody probably, I don't know if anybody came in, to be honest. I never heard. I hope they did.
Right, we'll skip forward to your next league win for Celtic. Crazy day at Love Street, 1986.
That was a day.
What do you remember of that final day, Hearts?
What I do remember is Al Minnali not reporting in because he was sick. And what I do remember, when we won the game and we were celebrating, and we all went into the dressing room, Al Minnali was sitting in the dressing room. Rambo was back.
Oh, Alan McCoystal was a great story. Was he a character, Alan McNally?
Aye, was good. Yeah, Bayern Munich, yeah. And you go down to Sky and you're there, he'll talk a little bit of Bayern Munich. These days of Bayern Munich. But that was an incredible day, you know. And Hearts, of course, going for the league. And us, you know, we played so well that day too. You know, some of the goals we scored was fantastic. Mm. I'm not saying who scored some of the goals up front. There was a certain guy there that day.
We don't want to give him any credit whatsoever.
You know?
Right, centenary season. Were Rangers spending big money? Did the team feel under pressure? Was it spoken about beforehand?
Did we feel under pressure? I think it was a season, actually, and I've said it so many times. That particular season, it was about like a play or a drama or a story that had to be told. And we were just the players, you know. We were just the actors, and it was kind of almost played out. I remember the start of the season, we got hammered here by Arsenal in a pre-season friendly, but it seemed to galvanise us a little bit. And then we won so many games that particular year, 1-0. The work rate was incredible. I think we closed teams down, and that came from a little bit at the start of the season when we went out to Sweden. And Billy was called back to Brian McClare's, I think it was his tribunal regarding his fee. And Tommy Craig was there, and he took us through a couple of sessions. Many sessions, almost shaping us out, pressing from the front, that type of stuff. Rogie, of course, was left back at the time. And I remember some sessions we did, and Rogie came off totally injured. and there was no opposition. He'd throw the ball out to him, and then he'd take a touch, and then he'd run after the ball, and he would go into, oh my God, up at Barfield, he ended up down the back, you know, down the back,
down the back,
in the trees and that. What a bad touch.
Oh, that's brilliant.
We had a great group of guys then.
What made that team spirit?
Absolutely. You know, McAvenny coming, Joe Miller coming at the time. We had Mark McGee, Andy Walker up front, those guys. Then Tommy and Billy Stark, you know, was there. Brilliant players. And Billy and Tommy were not the quickest players, but they played right and left. But the closing down that he did that year was incredible. And it's not about being quick. It's about using your brains, getting the right position, angles. Fantastic, Granty and Paul in the middle of the pitch. Big Mick came up and, you know, strengthened us up that particular year, the back two. No, it was a great group of players.
Was it hard playing under that pressure at all? The centenary of the year having
I don't think so. I can't remember the pressure. I think there was always pressure with Celtic, you know what I mean? No matter what game you play, you've got to go in one of them. If it's a reserve game, you remember, you go and play a reserve game, play a first team game. Go down to Vale of Leaven, for example, and a pre-season friendly or something like that. You had to win the game. Mm. Frank Connor wouldn't let you away with anything. So we were brought up that way, to handle pressure. So, no, I couldn't remember pressure. It was just the momentum of getting it going and making sure that we get over the line is the key.
You spoke about him, and he's a friend of the show, Frank McAvenny. How was he as a teammate? He's still mental, isn't he?
Frank's great. I go out and play golf a little bit with himself and Andy Walker and so on. And honestly, we go out and play golf, and if we start talking about football, we've 9 holes gone and he hasn't had a ball because I'll tell you this, oh, I remember this day. And I says, Frank, stop, we have to win this game. Gives you focus. And he's brilliant, you know, he is really, and a good guy, really, really good guy, but a funny guy, but also a fantastic player. Frank was probably, I know with Charlie Nicholas and all of Brian McClare and Alan McNally and all of those guys and Mark McGee, but Frank, I always say he was a combination of them all. He was the best player, striker I played. He could score goals, he could head the ball, he could run, he could tackle. He was an incredible guy, you know. And he loved the nightlife.
Was it as bad as it was made out, his night suit?
Oh, well, we never seen him because he was always down London or he was up in the sky trying to find his way up to Celtic Park. But we had good times. The only time he actually, I remember us being abroad one time, we stayed overnight and we all went out after a game. And Frank says, no, I'm not going out tonight. Not going out. It was Liam Brady and Joe Jordan was in charge. It must have been pre-season. He says, no, I'm not going out. I said, Frank, no, I'm not. I'm staying in. So we went out. We had a few drinks, as you do if you're going out. We came back to his room. He was rooming with Charlie. So Charlie came up to our room. We started a wee sing-song. Frank then jumps out of bed and he's sitting on the floor. Next thing, in comes Liam Brady. He says, hey, keep it down. Joe's not. Sorry, it was Joe Jordan came in. He's the manager. You keep it down. So, okay, Joe. So he leaves, and then we can continue, you know, and another wee sing song, and next thing, we're all fined. We're all fined the next day. And Macca was fined too. And it was the only night he never went out. So that was his big plead, but they wouldn't listen to him.
Did you ever go to the London Wimp?
No. I wouldn't hang around him. It was Alan McKnight, and who else would have been out with him? Alan McKnight. Few of the other younger boys. No, I was too old for that.
Uh-huh. Family man.
Family man. Absolutely.
Celtic left it late in the semi-final and the final that year. See, when you're trying to get a goal late on, what's it like standing in goal? Do you basically just become a fan watching the game?
The semi-final, I remember, of course, they score. It was against Hearts and they score. Big McPherson put me in the back of the definite free kick. To this day, it's a definite free kick.
Frank said you should have been stronger.
Look back at the footage. It's a definite free kick. Okay. Don't interrupt me now. I'm telling you, it was a free kick. But anyway, we were a goal down. Then suddenly we got back and we scored. And then the winner, you know, and Mike Evany scoring. And brilliant. And then the final. I missed the final. I was injured, which is.
How hard is that?
That was the worst moment of my life. I remember on a Tuesday, going up to train, and I ended up getting this real. My calf just went into spasm. I was having problems with my back, for that particular season, and then just my calf just went absolutely solid, and I couldn't walk on it. And then I got treatment of Brent Scott, and I was getting lots of treatment. I went down to Seamill, went out into the. You know, we used to train out in the back garden. 5-a-side fantastic games used to be in that back garden. Oh, quality was incredible. But I went out to train and do a fitness test. Just couldn't do it. And at that moment then, I had to go in and tell Alan McKnight that he was playing. And I must say, because it was centenary year, because it was a double, and it was such a an important game. I did have a few tears down sitting on that wall.
You did get a bit emotional.
Yeah, I got a wee bit emotional. Not like me, but I got a wee bit emotional that particular day. But then, of course, we went and won it, which was fantastic, you know. Didn't get a medal, but...
So whose back garden did you play five-a-sides in?
Down in the Seamill. Remember Seamill Mill Hydro?
No.
Nah, you see, you wouldn't have got there either. You just moved on to big-time stuff. We went down to Seamill Hydro, and that's where we trained out in the back garden. So anybody goes to Seamill Hydro, go out the back. There's two, almost, I would say, it's probably about 50 by 40, two-piece. And we played on the air, and there was unbelievable games there. The loser always went to see, by the way, afterwards.
Right.
And that, yeah, the losing team. But they were brilliant, brilliant games.
Who was the best striker in training, as in shooting, facing?
That's a good question, that.
Thanks very much, Pat. That's not even on the sheet. I've just came up with that.
That's a really good question. It's hard to know. I'll tell you who used to really... Well, I'm saying he used to annoy me. It was Mo Johnson. Mo Johnson was a great finisher. But I remember then after about 6 months, he used to stand... We used to play out behind the goal at Celtic Park. And Davey Hay was the manager. And we had these five-a-side goals. And all Mo did was sort of lean on the goals. And the play would go on. And then suddenly they would break up the other end. And he would run out and he would take the ball and he would score. And he was always standing behind me. And a five-a-side game. How can you stand behind somebody in a five-a-side game?
And he'd get away with that?
He'd get away with it. Davey Hay let him away with it. Was
he the golden boy?
Yeah, if I knew what was going to happen in the future, I might have given him a wee
one. Brilliant. Would the centenary year be the highlight of your Celtic career?
I'd think so, to a point, yeah. It was a year that was we talk about it now and everybody talks about it. It was a great team. You know, you had Chris Morris and Rogie in full-back positions, bombing forward, fit as a fiddle. Roy and Mick, and I talked about the team before. So it was a really good team, really good bond. And to win it that year to win the double that year was quite incredible. So I think it probably was. Then the 90s, we don't talk about. Don't even go there. The 90s. Well, we won the cup twice in the 90s, so that's okay.
See what you're saying about Mick and Roy. Was there always a good relationship between you and your two centre-halves, or was there a lot of arguments going on?
I got on well with Mick, to a point, right? But Mick was a shouter and a talker and an organiser. Roy was less of a shouter, but really quick. And I used to put them under pressure, you know, a bit of pressure, and sort them out, you know. Don't let them away with anything. Keep them there. Absolutely. You know.
Right, Euro 88, sorry. Jack Charlton, how was he?
Character, Jack was brilliant. Jack was a fantastic leader, fantastic man. Good for me. I had that sort of kind of, similar maybe to Big Billy relationship. Mm-hmm. As a goalkeeper, you know, you're always going to get criticised by the manager come in if you lose a goal or whatever, you know. And myself and Jack probably had that type of relationship also, you know. But what he did for me was he gave me responsibility. Billy would give you responsibility to a point, but Jack says to me one day, he says, he says, you're in charge of everything defensively. Everything defensively. And I was 26 when he took over, so I was about 28. Nobody ever said that to me before. So I had to go then and work out all the set pieces, defensive set pieces. Jerry Payton was the other goalkeeper. We roomed together. So we sat down. Then we had to go and speak to Mick McCarthy, Kevin Bourne, these guys, and almost go and organise them all. We did everything defensively.
That's
not the coach.
No, I've heard that before.
Yeah. But what it did for
did
me
like
was...
That, huh?
I loved it because I just grew with responsibility and all that. But what he did say to me, he says, if you get it wrong, you're answerable to me. So I couldn't get it wrong.
Was he a bit unorthodox in like his preparation and stuff like that as well, Jack?
Yeah, Jack was, you know. And he didn't like five-a-side football.
Really?
Because, he didn't like it because he felt as if you played little five-a-side football and then little boxes, you know, little boxes and you play and just one touch. He said, we'll be doing that in the game, so he didn't want that.
How did he just want it lunch?
Well, he wanted lunch to a point, but he was very clever. He was a very clever manager. He knew exactly how the opposition was going to play. He gave us little tips. I remember him talking to John Aldridge, for example, and saying, we played, Terry Butcher was with England. And he was a captain, of course, Rangers at the time. And he said about Terry Butcher, he says, listen, he says, Terry Butcher, he says, is all left-sided. And he says, and he'll knock the ball with the outside of his left foot and touch it and then go and play a ball up the line. He says, as soon as he lifts his left foot to do that, you run straight at him. And we'll see how good a player he is then, he says. And that kind of gives something in John's mind just to work on. What was the other player that played with Forrest? I'm trying to think of the guy who played alongside him. very, very quick. Des Walker.
Des Walker, eh?
Played very, he was very, very quick. And he says to him, he says, what he does, he says, he'll run, watch you, and just as you commit to the ball, he says, he'll pick up speed, you're out of the game, and then he'll turn away, and then he looks like a good player. And he says, slow down, as you go commit to the ball, you slow down, let him get the ball, and then put pressure on him. Then we'll see how good a player he is. Simple things, you think about
nuggets,
Wee Nuggets, fantastic.
How was he when you beat England 1-0 in the group?
He loved it.
And did he love you because you were man of the match?
No, he didn't actually.
What, you still got
me,
a bit?
Oh, he gave me so much stick in that game. He says, I should have been off me line. He should have been off me line, he says. And he was always scared of Mick and Kevin because the two of them was pretty slow, remember, on the turn. And he says, any ball over the top, that's your ball. And if you remember, I think it was Glenn Hoddle wasn't playing, and he came on in the second half, and he was clipping balls over Mick's shoulder for Lineker to run onto.
Right.
And I had a good game because I saved a lot of shots, but he wanted me to be out picking up those balls, and I couldn't. So we had this kind of a ongoing argument, and then after, in the press conference after the game, he absolutely slaughtered me for not coming off my line. And then he took me out onto the pitch. I think it was a couple of days later or something, and he says, I want you standing, you know, little arc outside the 18?
Yeah.
He says, I want you standing out there. I says, Jack, that's too far off. He says, that's where I want you standing. And he says, okay, I'll show you. And he put all the players in the halfway line with a ball each. Now, no pressure on the players, every player. And he says, try and chip them. So he started kicking these balls over my head, and I'm running back like an idiot, trying to get these balls, and one or two in the net and the rest. And he says, look, 10 of them, they've gone wide. I said, hold on a second. Try it again. So all the players picked up a ball again. Next thing, there was about 10 balls in the back. And they said, he says, you make up your own mind.
Brilliant. Conceded late against eventual winners Holland and miss out in a semi-final place.
Yeah.
Do you still look back and think, what?
Oh, that was a great team, the Dutch team too. They went on to win it. USSR at the time, not, you know, which was the culmination of all those Eastern Bloc states. They were all USSR at the time. Great team. I can still remember that Kuznetsov played, Mikhailchenko played, Belanov played, Protasov played, Dasyev and goals. I can still name the team all these years later. Almost a really good team. And we drew with them. We drew, but we got beat 1-0 against Holland, the eventual one. And they had a fantastic team. Also, Rijkaard, Koeman, Hulet, Van Basten, you know. What do you call him? What was the player to play with Aberdeen?
Stuart McKimmy.
No, Stuart McKimmy. No, one of the Dutch players who actually played that day, or I think it was maybe 1990 when the Dutch team too, really good team.
Yale House,
yeah. He played, I think it was 1990, he didn't play in 88, but he played 1990. But it's amazing, an Aberdeen player playing with that fantastic Dutch team, when you think back on it. But no, listen, they were a great team, but the goal should have been disallowed. I look back at the goal now, at that time, you were offside. It wasn't a case you were in second phase or you were running out and the ball hit the ground, spun in, but Van Basten, I think, was offside.
Van Basten. Right. Italia 90, Ireland qualified for their first World Cup. Yeah. How proud are you to be going as the number one?
Yeah, that was huge for us because we had the taste of 88. Beating England, of course, was enormous. And then qualifying for the World Cup and going to 1990, the Irish team, and getting to the quarter final. We were down in Sicily for the Sardinian Sicily for the start of it.
Oh, lovely.
Took Scotland's place up in Rapallo in the hotel there. I'm trying to think of the name of the hotel, I can't remember. But Scotland were papped home,
right,
and we took their place in that hotel.
Can I believe it? That's what I mean.
We drew with them on a wet, cold day down in Sardinia, and then we drew all our games. We drew with Egypt, and then we drew with Holland, and then we went up. And we drew with Romania, but beat them in penalties.
Yeah.
And then got beaten in the quarterfinal against the great Italian team, the fantastic Italian team. But the great story in that particular one is the one where our Taoiseach, our Prime Minister, who wasn't really into football, and because we had got to the quarterfinal, but he had to go to Rome to watch us play. And the game was over. We got beat 1-0 against Scalacci. And, And 2 days before that, we went to see the Pope, because I had saved the penalty, we had a private audience with the Pope in front of 2,000 people, and I was brought up and I was sort of talked to the Pope and shook his hand and did what I had to do. And then he started talking to me because he was a goalkeeper too when he was young.
No way.
He, in Poland. So he started, I'm the portier. And I said, yes, yes. And then he said, I was a goalkeeper and I had new congratulations and so on. So all the cameras were going and photographs. And it was all over the news and everything out there. So then 2 days we got beat against Italy. And Datisha was there anyway, Datisha, and he was going round and that. And he wanted Jack Charlton to go round the stadium with him and that. And then sort of the doors burst open and he comes in away. And our physio says, oh, Datisha's here, Datisha's here. And Andy Townsend and Tony Cashgrove sitting with me, said to each other, and he goes into this big speech, Datisha. Gentlemen, you've done the country proud. You've done me proud. You've done your families proud. And Andy says to Cassie, who's that geezer? and I think Tony says, I don't know, but I think he owns a tea shop.
Oh, that's tremendous.
Yeah. But later on then we're waiting to get ourselves organized, and Jack's in the dressing room and he's over talking to Andy Townsend and he's smoking a cigarette, and this is about an hour after we finished, and I said, better go in and get showered and that, and we're all a bit disappointed. And I got up and I went by, and the next thing out of the corner is my Jack says, the Pope would have saved that one.
Oh, I love Jack Charlton, what a guy. Right, we're just going to go back to Celtic quickly. Lou McCarrie and Liam Brady. Now, Frank McAvenny did not have nice things to say about Lou McCarrie. Was that the same feeling throughout the squad?
I think so. To a point, you know. To a point. Everybody had their own you know, things with Lou McCarrie. Obviously, Mackie had him down at West Ham. We had him up here. And he was unorthodox. It wasn't what we were used to. You know, we came into training, we worked hard. We were what, you know, Billy McNeil or, you know, Davy Hay, and they were Celtic people. And we trained really hard. Everything was perfect. Now, Lou's stuff was completely off the wall. I must admit, it was completely different. And it didn't suit us. I didn't think it suited any of us. So, to be honest, I think that's probably why. And he probably had to change things, and he had to bring new players in. The players maybe he brought in weren't good enough either, you know. So that didn't help. If you bring in new players into a group and they're not as good as the players that were already there, then
trouble.
You know, there's trouble. So from that perspective, yeah. So you want me to condemn Lou McCarrie?
No, Frank's already done that.
But he was different.
How were you when you were told by him that you were leaving Celtic?
Well, I kind of knew that probably that day was going to come, and I myself resigned to it. The fact that he didn't tell me until I got off the bus down the Parkhead after being up in Dundee United, and that was it, and I was gone. I don't think that was the right way to do it. And Shea Given was also freed that particular year too, and he was only a kid, and he went on to be, you know, become an unbelievable goalkeeper. So it was just the way he went about doing it, you know. You don't come off a bus at Celtic Park after a game, travel down, and be told that you're freed, and then you're gone, you know.
Mm-hmm. You knew it was coming, but you're still devastated.
I think there's 17 years of your life, you're kind of, you're devastated, of course, because it's a way of life, you know. You get up in the morning, you automatically get the kids ready, drop them off for school, you drive into Celtic Park, you do your training, and then suddenly it's finished. Mm. What do I do now, you know? Life takes a different turn, you know, and you've got to get on with it.
And you signed for your pal, Tommy Burns at Kilmarnock.
I didn't sign, but I nearly signed.
Did you see what was going to come that summer?
I went down and spoke to Tommy and Starkey and the chairman, Bob Fleeting at the time, and we'd agreed a deal. And everything was fine, and I was looking forward to it actually, because I was going back obviously to work with Tommy and Billy, and I was going down kind of as a goalkeeper, but also do a little bit of coaching. I had kind of asked Tommy about taking Shea down there also, which would be incredible. If we could get him at that particular time, and I think we probably could have, because he was down at Blackburn. He hadn't signed with Blackburn at that point in time, and we could have got him. Then I went to the World Cup, in the middle of the World Cup in 1994, and then I got a phone call in the middle of the World Cup from Tommy to say that he was going back to Celtic Park. And the question was, would I come back? And I couldn't probably say no. And in fact, maybe now when I look back on it, in one way I wish I didn't go back, because I was looking forward to going to Kilmarnock just to network new people. meet new guys, a complete change. And I was 34 years old at the time. But I was going back to Selly Park also to be a goalkeeper and to be a coach. So then my coaching sort of career started from that point. And I'm still involved in football, so all these years later. So
how delighted were you for Tommy? Can you remember the phone call? Was he over the moon?
Yeah, he was over the moon. I think he was apprehensive also because he was young. Tommy was fairly young. And he'd done so well at Kilmarnock. And you know what happened afterward? Words with that, with the whole kind of, I think there was a tribunal and all that around it, you know, so, and then himself and Starkey. But I suppose in one way, I was going to work with guys who I knew, Tommy and Billy. That's why I was going to Kilmarnock in the first place. I knew how passionate they were about the game. I knew that they taught about the game quite differently. And that Tommy was really eager to make his mark. Difficult with Fergus McCann, of course, during that particular period. And that was always something that was sort of probably, to this day, probably I wish Tommy had to get, when he was alive, got a second chance at it. And yeah. I think he might have got that chance if he didn't take on well. And I think he would have been a great manager later on. He was still young at that particular time.
Mm. As you say, you got into the coaching and you went to the World Cup in 2002 and you caused the whole ruckus with Roy.
It's a long story, actually, you know. It was a fortunate story because, you know, the World Cup at that particular time was a whole group of new fans, young kids, you know, who had never witnessed 88 or 94, yeah. And they were desperate for a World Cup. But Roy, there was something up with Roy. Even from the day we left Dublin, Roy wasn't himself. There was definitely something up. He won't tell you what it was.
Paul Pogba, probably.
He does, yeah. But, you know, on the day, what happened was that we were training out in Saipan. We had, unfortunately, all of the gear that was coming with DHL got caught in, I think it was in America, actually. It didn't get to Saipan in time, but we had taken stuff with us. And that was the first problem because Roy kind of blew up about that, you know. Where's all the gear and all that, you know. But these things happen. But we were down in Saipan, and then the pitch was not good. It wasn't a good, you can imagine, out in an island out in Saipan. So they blew up about that also. And Mick had a talk about not going home and so on. And then we were going down to do a training session, and I brought the goalkeepers down. Alan Kelly,
yeah,
and Shea. And I was doing a half an hour with them, and it was boiling hot, you can imagine, 30 degrees. And we worked really hard because I wanted to keep the goalkeepers going, taking over. And then the team came down, and then they sort of did a shooting session that Ian Evans was doing. And the goalkeepers again worked for another sort of 30 minutes on that, really hard. And at the end of it, Alan Kelly said to me, listen, he says, we don't want to play in the five, because Mick always played a bit of a five-a-side at the end. And I said, no problem, I'll have a word with Mick. So Mick says, yeah, no problem, we'll play with the last man in, that type of stuff. And Roy blew up about that. He says, where's the goalkeepers? Where's the goalkeepers? And I says, no, they're tired, Roy. That's what they should be. You know, so he was in a bad form. So anyway, game finished, and we were down in the tent area, and then comes Roy. And the unfortunate bit about it was that he started on to me about the goalkeepers again. I says, Roy, leave it. And he had a bottle of water in his hand, and he went to finish, and he threw the bottle away like this here. But there was one photographer, and he took a snap, and it looked as if he was throwing a bottle at me, right, the way the camera caught it. So that was fine. He went away then. I think Alan Kelly had a few words with him there. And then we went up, and there was a press conference on, and there was one of the Sky guys was there. What's the name of the guy? Lovely lad he was. And he went up and asked our press guy, who's an older man, he says, was there a bit of a rumpus down in the training with Packy and Roy? And he says, oh, geez, yeah, oh, there was, oh, they were at it. They were at it, the two of them. Oh, my God. So that was a story. Uh-huh. And next thing, out of nothing, the story broke that we had fallen out and that Roy was coming home and that. And then because of the eight-hour difference, that went on here, and we were in our bed. And I woke up in the morning and my wife was phoning me and she says, what's happened to you and Roy? And I says, what? Nothing. And these things happen. Mm. And I says, why, what happened? And she says, oh, Roy's coming home and all that. And you've been involved in it. And I says, so I went downstairs and I was a little bit late going down for breakfast. And the only two people that was in the room when we went down was Roy and Alan Kelly. the two guys were supposed to be fighting, and I was supposed to fight, and we had breakfast together. And I says, Roy, what stuff going on at home in the media? He says, oh, forget the media. He says, and then about another day later, he wanted to go home again, you know. So he always wanted to go home, but I got to blame of it. That's the story.
Is he a scary guy?
No, Roy was, I used to wind him up, and myself and Jerry Payton, and saying there was a big statue down in Cork that the girls used to come up and rub themselves on, you know what I mean? that kept him happy.
But you proud of the team overcome that? They did really well, didn't they?
They did that. They played very well. And I think they got something from that, actually. And, you know, obviously Roy left and Mick and him had this argument and Roy disappeared. But I think players just reacted in a positive way and nearly emulated what we did in the quarterfinals of the World Cup.
Yeah.
Nearly got there, got beat against Spain and the one before that, the last 16, you know. So it was incredible. In fact, I got a text from Shay Given today. I think they're playing, he's goalkeeper coach at Derby, asking me for some advice on penalties. And I said, I wish I had to give that advice to him when we were playing against Spain.
but lastly, on winning the Scottish Cup in 1985, how delighted were you for Tommy and obviously yourselves all the work you'd put into it?
There was a lot of pressure that day. When you talk about pressure, that was a pressure day because Tommy hadn't won anything. And it was more for him than anything else. You know, we've had our career as players. I was coming to the end. Of course, it was my last game. And to win a cup medal in your last game, I think Big Billy had that in 75, I had 95, to walk away with it. But it was more for Tommy, absolutely. The motion was around mixture of, and Billy Stark, of course, but Tommy in particular.
Who did you like for that team? As a coach-wise, players, who did you like?
Well, we had Van Hooijdonk was coming, you know, and he was a tremendous player. I'm not sure if, I think it was the following year, Canio and Tom and him came in. And maybe Tom was in at the same time too. But we had a good enough team. It was against Airdrie. We were one that we were expected to win. But we didn't really play that well on the day. But it was just getting that goal that Van Hooijdonk got up and headed.
Yeah.
And the game didn't matter. How we played didn't really matter. Just winning it on that day. But it didn't help. Tommy didn't keep him in the job.
And then back to Tommy's karaoke.
Oh, we had a bit of a night that night, all right, absolutely.
Brilliant. And just finally, how do you look back on your Celtic career?
With pride, you know. I don't think there'd be many people who play 17 years at a club. It was my full career there. Lots of great people throughout it, great players I played with, managers, even all of them, even the ones that maybe at the end I didn't really get on with, or even the Lou McCarries, I still took something from it. And when you look back and you get older, you look at championships and cups and stuff that you won, it's only now that you really appreciate them. You know, and we talk about 1985, the appreciation of winning your last one, because it's the last one. You can't win anymore. You look back and then you say probably that was the most important one.
Right, thanks very much, Paco.
Okay, Sam.
Top line.
Good to see you.
Cheers.